RCR with Paul Brennan.
Vanessa Beely is an independent journalist, peace activist and photographer. She was a finalist for one of the most prestigious journalism awards, the 2017 Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism. She's been a guest on our program here at RCR a couple of times already, most recently, I think, August last year. In fact, I can tell you what the subject line for that was: her big picture analysis of Middle East tensions and where it's all headed. And Vanessa Beely joins us now. I think you're beaming in from Beirut, Lebanon, Vanessa, are you?
Yes, that's right. Yep, no longer in Syria.
Because you were in Damascus.
So I was in Damascus until the international coup took place. And unfortunately, after 14 years of regime change war, finally, the Syrian government was toppled and the country is under the control of Al-Qaeda.
For us folk at the bottom of the world, that seemed to happen all of a sudden, the events in Syria. But I'm sure there was plenty leading up to it, and it's more complicated than that. I want to try and get a big sort of picture view here, if you don't mind. But let's start in Syria. What happened there? Because Assad has been made out in all the reporting here to be a nasty guy with the Alawite sort of background. And now it seems that maybe he wasn't so bad. I know it's a very simplistic way of putting it, but maybe you can sort of take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, look, basically, I don't know if people are aware, but there was a regime change war waged against Syria since 2011, of course, with the normal kind of what I call Hitlerization of another leader of a sovereign nation that basically was not going to comply with a Western Zionist agenda in the region, a neo-colonialist agenda, effectively, and was part of the resistance axis. When I talk about the resistance axis, I'm talking about, of course, from Iran to Yemen to Iraqi resistance factions to Syria, which was a resistance state, if you like, to Lebanon, to Palestine. And so that entire axis was to a large degree dependent upon Syria as its hub, as the main bridge from Iran and Iraq to bring weapons to the Lebanese resistance and to the Palestinian resistance. But on top of that, Syria was responsible for the manufacture of many of the weapons that went to the Palestinian resistance factions to defend themselves, of course, against an oppressive occupation force that had been put in place by the British and then kind of adopted by the United States post the 1948 Nakba catastrophe, which was the initial ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Palestine, from what is now the occupied territories and Gaza. And so really, because President Assad, many reasons, but the primary reason was that he wouldn't abandon his alliance or his role in that resistance axis. He wouldn't abandon Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance. He wouldn't abandon Palestine. And he rejected the Qatari-Turkish pipeline in favor of the Russian-Iranian pipeline. That was the final straw, basically, because the West tried to court him. Post 9/11, the West, there are Bush and Blair, Tony Blair communiques talking about trying to bring Syria on board. I mean, it's way more complex than this, but I'm just condensing it down.
I understand. Yep.
So up until 2009, they actually tried to get him on board and to abandon his principles and abandon the resistance, and he refused. And so therefore, in 2011, the regime change war was waged against Syria, while he had been, to a large degree, praised and sought after pre-2009, it began to go downhill. After that, after 2011, of course, he became criminalized and he became just like Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi, all these leaders that don't comply with Western imperialism suddenly become, as I said, Hitlerized. They become the greatest criminal on the planet. And as you quite rightly pointed out, since the Al-Qaeda coup, we can come into why I'm still calling it Al-Qaeda, in December last year, and I was present, I was on the ground during the actual battles, and then I was in Damascus in the last hours before I also was forced to leave. basically what we've seen since then, thousands of deaths, thousands of incarcerations of minority groups inside Syria, including Christians, and you mentioned the Alawites. That never happened under President Assad, much as the propaganda from the West tried to portray it as happening the whole time under
Yeah, I
the
think in your
presidency.
Substack, I saw you lay out, key positions in the military, for example, and other government
Yes,
entities,
exactly.
and it was like a sort of like a United
A
Nations.
Sunni roll call. Yes.
So just saying, yeah, carry on, sorry.
No. And so what we've seen, of course, since President Assad left or was forced to leave, we've seen an absolute deterioration of the security and stability in Syria. I mean, I recently had friends here that have managed to escape. I've visited Akkar in northern Lebanon, where more than 10,000 refugees have fled the coastal areas of Syria to escape effectively ethnic cleansing, a genocide of an entire sect inside Syria that is perceived to be affiliated to President Assad. But the reality is the Alawites are some of the poorest agricultural communities in Syria that were actually, I would say, in my experience, marginalized in order not to give them the favoritism that the president was accused of doing, right?
Want to
So
keep
in
them sort of
fact,
under
they
the
didn't.
radar for safety purposes, almost.
No, yeah, basically to not play into that propaganda. So largely they were actually they sacrificed their sons and daughters for the regime change war. But actually, they were very much marginalized and not paid any attention by the government. This was a regular complaint from them. Like, for example, families that lost soldiers in the war, they were not given compensation quickly, whereas other more majority sects inside Syria were given greater attention, let's say. So it was actually a total absolute lie, really, that this group is any threat whatsoever to any other sect within Syria. And now they're basically being ethnically cleansed, as I said, and slaughtered because of this perceived affiliation to President Assad.
Remind us again who the HTS are. What are their origins? What do they come out of?
Well, HTS is basically Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. But if why I continue calling them Al-Qaeda is because, of course, the now so-called unelected, self-proclaimed president of Syria, who's also changed his name from Muhammad al-Julani to Ahmed al-Sharaa, that's how you will know him, of course, in the media. He basically was incubated by the West in Camp Buqqa. He initially in Iraq, he initially was recruited by ISIS, which of course is another US proxy inside Syria and Iraq. And he then formed Al-Qaeda in Syria, which was known as Nusra Front. Certainly in the first few years of the war against Syria, that's the name that you would have heard. He then basically, I think, because he was, he's always been under control by MI6 and CIA, but actually, I think more MI6 related from a PR point of view. He then changed from Nusra Front to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, in an effort to distance himself from that Al-Qaeda image.
Bad look, bad marketing.
Yeah, basically. And
Re
if you remember, I
rebranding,
think
basically.
it, yeah, and if you remember, I think it was in 2018, what's his name? Martin Smith of PBS, they groomed him up, they combed his beard and put him in a suit and tried to make out that he's some kind of legitimate opposition. But the reality is the Al-Qaeda ideology doesn't change. If you look at every member of the government, they were all former HTS, Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda members. They committed atrocities against Syrian civilians, recorded atrocities. Including summary executions and stoning and so on and so forth. And actually, the majority of them have Turkish citizenship, not Syrian citizenship.
Right.
The army now, because of course the original Syrian Arab army was dissolved completely, huge numbers of them, tens of thousands, are incarcerated. And they dissolved the army. Of course, Israel, immediately after the fall of Damascus, obliterated the Syrian defense and military capability, destroying air defense, destroying air bases, destroying everything that would enable Syria to defend itself as a sovereign nation. And effectively, you know, we have al-Qaeda in charge of Syria conducting genocide, conducting ethnic cleansing, enforcing Sharia law. And I'm not going to call it Islamic law, because HTS, al-Qaeda, are more of a branch of Islam that is a distortion of Islam, Wahhabi or Muslim Brotherhood. Both of them are extremist branches of Islam that were generated from Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Particularly the Wahhabi doctrine comes from, very much from Saudi Arabia. And that's basically who is in charge of Syria right now. As much as the West tries to change the optics for them, it's not, you know, it doesn't wash, basically.
You mentioned the pipeline before as the last straw. Mm. What's all this about in the end? Is it about oil? Is it about strip mining riches of that part of the world? Or is that just part of it? Why would that have been the final straw?
Well, that was the final straw because, in a sense, what that did was, if you imagine, you have, I guess, the three lines of attack, the main three lines of attack against Syria are the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Turkey and Qatar, right? So the Turkish-Qatari pipeline was rejected. So that immediately put the Muslim Brotherhood in competition with what is perceived as the Shia Muslim crescent, which is Iran and Yemen. And right. OK, so that's the first thing. Israel, of course, for Israel, Syria represented, as I said, the land bridge for the resistance and also the main producer of weapons for the Palestinian resistance. So Syria had always been a nemesis for Israel. And if we go back to 1997, the Clean Break Doctrine, which was put together by CIA operatives for Netanyahu then you'll see that the reason that Iraq was attacked first is because the road to Damascus goes through Baghdad. So Iraq was designed to fall before Syria, but that basically Syria would be the target for Israel and the entire region to be partitioned, to be divided up into small statelets that are more manageable for Israel and don't present the same level of threat. Hence why, of course, Israel bombed Syria immediately, bombed all of its defense capability to prevent it re-emerging as any kind of resistance against Israel in the next 50 to 100 years, quite honestly, because Syria is now completely carved up. I mean, we'll come on to that. And then, so we had Turkey, Qatar, Israel, and then, of course, the West. And the West is very much in defense of Israel, in defense of the Zionist movement, the control of resources, as you mentioned, that's oil, but also for Israel, water. If you look at the fact that in the occupied Golan Heights, Israel takes 30% of its water usage from the Golan territory that it occupied in 67, it's advanced to south of Damascus since the fall of Damascus. And it's controlling a huge percentage. I think it's 40% of Jordan's water usage from there. And again, it's taken a huge amount of Syrian water resources there. And the idea for Israel now is to extend up the eastern border of Syria, what is known as David Corridor in the kind of Zionist agenda, to take control of all of that eastern border with Jordan and Iraq, and to ultimately arrive at the Euphrates in Iraq. And this is part of the greater Israel plan, which, effectively Israel is putting into practice right now. So the West's agenda is very much to support Israel, to weaken and in the end destroy which is what we're seeing happening right now, to destroy any resistance against Israel and against Israeli Zionist expansionism, and to end Palestine, basically, on behalf of Israel.
Why are we all in with Zionism? That's a curious question, because not many
No,
people
it's
have
a
thought
good
that through
question.
when you hear them talking or debating it. But why is everything thrown in behind that? It seems that's the case.
I can only speak from let's say a US and a UK point of view. For example, in the UK, if you look at the 2030 Israeli-UK roadmap, you'll see to what extent Israel, and by Israel I'm talking about the Zionist movement, has infiltrated every sector of UK society and is effectively gaining greater and greater control. So of cyber surveillance, of any kind of health, education, anything related to governance. It's deeply embedded in that. And the same in the US. There isn't a US president that can be elected without Zionist support. And actually, President Trump, and this is what I was saying right from the beginning, he's a total Zionist administration. There isn't one member of his administration that is not pro-Israel or at least pro-Zionist or Christian Zionist. So what we're in now is a sort of an era of, in my opinion, Israel isn't going to back off in any way, shape, or form. And we've heard Trump recently talking about attacking Hamas, attacking the Houthis, attacking Iran, attacking Iraq. In other words, destroying any resistance to the Zionist control of the region. But I think this is an important fact for people to understand. And if they want to read a lot more about it, I would recommend going to Professor David Miller, who it might be interesting for you to have on, because he's a real expert on the Zionist movement, how it began, how it's infiltrated, how it's taken control of so many of our institutions in the West. And we see this. I mean, look at what's happening now with anyone who is against the genocide of Palestine. I mean, they're being arrested, they're being detained, they're being kicked out of their countries, their visas are being retracted. You know what I mean? This is total state control by the Zionist movement.
Yeah, because even in this small part of the world down here, already people are siding off against each other. You've got the pro-Palestinians and you've got the pro-Israelis, and it's kind of getting intense. And it's thousands of miles away. It really has, well, maybe it does have an effect here, but it seems to be dividing a lot of people, a lot of
Yeah, very
Populations.
much.
It has a global effect. It's interesting because, Trump talks about, it would never have happened if I was president. I could solve this in one day. We have no, strategic interest in Ukraine. Well, what's the strategic interest apart from preserving Israel that the U.S. has that means anything to U.S. citizens in that part of the world? Because going by what he says about other conflicts, I don't see why they're there.
I mean, for me, I think the clearest statement was made pre-election by Robert Kennedy Jr. when he basically he outlined the importance of Israel for the United States and why everybody, when they're talking about the Middle East, they talk about the defense of Israel. It's because Israel, as I said, it was very much adopted by the US. It was a UK project which was picked up by the United States. It acts as not only a military outpost for the United States in the Middle East, it provides surveillance, it provides intelligence on the entire region, it provides, as he described it, interference But also the most important thing, of course, is that it represents a barrier against, for example, Chinese expansion or even Russian expansion. So against the Belt and Road Initiative, because Israel is pivotal to the, what's it called? The India Middle East Economic Corridor, which goes from Mumbai through the Gulf states, through the occupied territories of Palestine, known as Israel, into the Sinai, into Arish, and then to Europe. So effectively what it's doing is cutting out Turkey and China. Having said that, China has invested in the ports in Israel, in particular in Haifa. So I think, you know, China is probably to some degree a step ahead and saying, well, okay, if you're going to do that, but then we're going to invest in, you know, I look at China very much as a pragmatic player, same as Russia. They will take care of their own interests, regardless of who that means they align with or who they work with. They're not what I call ideological countries. They're not anti-imperialist, as much as people would love to believe that. They're completely pragmatic in their foreign policy. And we're seeing that right now with the conversations that are clearly going on between Putin and Trump. And in my opinion, based on what happened on the ground, Russia effectively abandoned Syria because they saw an opportunity to make a deal on Ukraine. And now they're working with Israel to be able to come back to Syria, consolidate their military base on the coastal region, and potentially be in control of the eventual partitioning of the coast, because that's what people are looking for now, because the slaughter and the genocide has been ongoing since December. And people don't want to live under this anymore. It's horrendous. So almost anything is better than HDS. And so, of course, that's an invitation to partitioning. Israel in the south, Turkey in the north, and potentially, if Russia goes ahead and can create this collaboration, which it is trying to do with Israel, it will get control of the coastal area and offer the protection for the Alawites and Christians in that area. So, you know, I think both of those countries play a very real politic role in the region. But I think Israel has been instrumental in providing everything that the US needed to get control of the region to a large extent, or at least be comfortable with the people it's working with in that region, rather than having what it perceives as enemies in control of their own countries, but not doing what the US wants them to do, basically.
So, okay, does America ultimately control Israel if it's like some sort of aircraft carrier out in the Middle East that it can operate from, that's how I was visualizing it, or is it the other way around?
It's interesting because I was having that conversation here today. And I think how I look at it is Israel, if you like, is it's also an instrument for the Zionist movement.
Right.
It's right. So it's Israel to a degree, like everybody focuses in on Israel, but actually the bigger picture is the Zionist movement.
Yeah.
And so Israel has been useful for the Zionist movement and thus for the United States. I don't actually make any differentiation between the US and the Zionist movement, because they're twinned now. You can't have one without the other. One funds the other. And then that enables them to put pressure on policies and so on and so forth. But they're absolutely symbiotic, in my opinion. Israel, for me now, is a bit of a... It's a bit of a red herring, because if we focus on Israel, what happens if Israel disappears tomorrow? Let's say Israel moves to Ukraine, which is where actually the majority of Zionists came from.
That's interesting, isn't it?
In Palestine. Yeah. You know, Odessa is known as the Gate of Zion. Golda Meir was born in Kiev. The majority, or a huge number of IDF commanders and so on, were born in Ukraine. Right. Wow. Because a lot of the settlers in the occupied territories came from Eastern Europe, and a huge majority from Ukraine. And Ukraine is the home of Chabad Lubavitch, which is one of the biggest kind of Zionist related movements. Yabotinsky, one of the formative theorists of Zionism came from
Is that why
Ukraine,
the
Republic
US
of
were in, sorry
Ukraine.
to jump in, but is that why the US were fighting the proxy war in Ukraine? Is that, can I dare to ask, was that really the main driver?
I don't know if it was the main driver, because this is still kind of a, if you like, this is still a germ of an idea in my head, but I'm not the only one that has this idea. But I think my point is the concept of Israel is something that has been manufactured to a point where everybody focuses on that instead of moving out and saying the bigger picture of the Zionist movement, because that's going to affect all of us globally. It's not only focused on Israel. Do you see what I mean? And like everyone, even on the resistance axis, are talking about, yes, but Israel's going to have a civil war, and even Israelis are talking about that now. And you're seeing the re-emergence of the kind of terrorist groups like Irgun, Stern Gang, and so on inside Israel that are challenging the Knesset. So there is a degree of division between the absolute far right extremists and end timers, as they call them. And the more, you don't have any left wing in Israel anymore, but the more conservative right wing, right? So there is a clash from that degree. I'm not saying any of them don't want to genocide the Palestinians or don't want to completely ethnically cleanse what remains of slivers of Palestinian territory that haven't yet been settled on. So there is a potential for that. But in my opinion, that isn't going to affect that larger Zionist movement, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It's just interesting that the linkage is there, not apparent at first to just anyone taking cursory glances at news, to know how the piece parts fit together. Up against time pretty well. Are we going to see a wider conflict? What's your gut feel on that? I mean, it seems to be a lot of pressure on Iran at the moment. The Houthis are firing maybe hypersonic missiles, which, that's pretty high-tech weaponry and can rip into anywhere at incredible speeds, hard to defend against. It seems to have the potential to keep spiraling more towards a wider conflict. Is that your sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think, and I think part of that is because where does Israel go from here? They can't go back. They've pretty much destroyed southern Lebanon. They're still embedded in southern Lebanon. They didn't leave despite the agreement and the ceasefire agreement. They're still there. And they're still carrying out attacks. Like yesterday, they were bombing southern Lebanon. They were carrying out drone strikes in the northeast on the border with Syria. They're still bombing targets in Syria despite having obliterated pretty much everything back in December. And in Palestine, we're seeing the encroaching on what's left of the West Bank, the destruction of the West Bank, which is not really getting reported. As much as Gaza, the genocide has restarted in Gaza over some spurious excuse that Hamas didn't follow through on the ceasefire agreement, which is never the case. It's always Israel that breaks the ceasefire and violates it. And we're seeing, a ramping up of the killing of Palestinians there. I mean, thousands have been killed in the last few days alone, three journalists in the last 24 hours. And what they're doing in Syria, they're advancing, they're expanding on an almost daily basis, of course, with the complete agreement of Jolani and the so-called government that's in control right now. And I don't see how it goes back. Like, what's it going to go back to? Being the most hated entity in the region, surrounded by enemies, it's not going to go back to that. So it has to keep going. It has to go forward. And with the Trump administration, it's got full support. That was always going to be the case. That was why Trump was brought back in, because he would give absolute full support. Everyone thought Biden was the worst it could possibly get. But Trump was always going to come in and fully support them. Is there going to be a war against Iran? I don't know. There is currently, of course, a war again against Yemen and against Ansarullah. The Houthis, by the way, is kind of a it's sort of a dismissive Western media label given to an entire resistance movement, which is known as Ansarullah, which is actually part of the constitutionally elected government in Yemen. So just to, because it's it's people assume the Houthis are just some kind of tribal faction that is leading this war against Israel and the United States. And I also want to remind people that what Yemen was doing against Israeli shipping was totally legitimate under the Geneva Genocide Convention. They were respecting Article 1 and Article 2, I think it is, which is to prevent genocide and to punish those committing genocide. So what Ansarullah was doing was completely legitimate and morally legitimate, right? The war that is now being waged against them is, of course, completely illegitimate. And what's the US doing? It's bombing hospitals and the UK, bombing hospitals, schools, et cetera, civilian and residential areas, again, to try and put pressure to stop the Yemeni actions against Israel and against US and UK allied shipping. It's not going to work. So, yes, I think we are heading for escalation because I don't see where else it can go, to be quite honest.
Final question in that situation, who wins potentially?
Well, you have an axis of resistance, which is, it is David and Goliath because they're up against what? The might of the United States and the entire Five Eyes alliance, Turkey, even Russia, if they come back into it now, very much pivoting towards the West, let's say over Ukraine and so on. I don't know who wins. That's a very difficult one to say, but at the end of the day, this is an existential war. It is Arabs, not only the Syrians and Palestinians and Lebanese and Yemenis. It's Arabs fighting to preserve their culture, their civilization, their nation states, against what is really a kind of neo-crusader movement again, to take them over. Dubai them, as I keep saying, Dubaify them, remove all of the historical, incredible civilization that has existed for 10,000 years in Syria and replace it with hideous Dubai-style skyscrapers, bring in the IMF and the economic jackals. Yeah, it's an existential war, and it's not one that the resistance is going to back down from. So we're heading for interesting times.
So get ready, buckle up if you haven't already. All right, Vanessa Bealey, it's been really fascinating catching up with you. Thank you for making some time. Well, this maybe we'll talk again, maybe sooner than maybe 6 or 7 months because of the developments and the
Yeah,
speed of
would be
them.
great.
Be safe. Thank you again
I
for coming
will.
on our program.
No, thank you ever so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure.